Roy. Hey, Roy. Hi, Joyce. All right. Acts chapter 1 is about Ascension Apostle. Good. You guys are going to have this all memorized by the time we're done. Acts chapter 2 is about Spirit Kingdom. Acts chapter 3 is about Second Sermon. Acts chapter 4 is about Peter's defense, because Peter, John, and the crippled man are arrested from in chapter 3. Then you get to chapter 5. What's chapter 5 about? First discipline, second defense. Now, who were the two individuals that were disciplined in chapter 5? Ananias and Sapphira. And then who was arrested in the second defense? It was all the apostles, all 12 of them. Good. Now, Acts chapter 6, here's the tricky one, is about the seven. Acts chapter 7 is about? That's right, Stephen's defense or Stephen's death. Acts chapter 8, we're going to break this down into three parts. Who is the primary evangelist in Acts chapter 8? It's Philip, that's right. It's been Peter this whole time, now it's Philip, just for one chapter. And then with Philip, who is the first individual that is our main concern in Acts chapter 8? Simon the sorcerer. And then in the second part, it is the eunuch. That's right, Ethiopian eunuch. Now, we get introduced to the main historical character for the rest of the book of Acts. Acts chapter 9 is about Saul's conversion. Then in Acts chapter 10, we have a duplicate of Acts chapter 2, but with the Gentiles. So Acts chapter 10 is about Gentiles, Spirit, Kingdom. There you go. Now, Peter's going to come back to Jerusalem, so Acts chapter 11 is about him bringing back a report of what happened, and then the first Gentile, primarily church, is established, and that is what church? Antioch. Acts chapter 13, what takes place in Acts chapter 13? It's the first journey that begins. And so, naturally, Acts chapter 14, the first journey is shorter. Acts chapter 14 is the first journey ends or is completed. Big deal happens in Acts chapter 15. What is Acts chapter 15 about? The Jerusalem conference. And what was the decision that was made at the Jerusalem conference? That they did not have, the Gentiles did not have to receive circumcision to be saved and did not have to keep the law. Now we get to Acts chapter 16. Acts chapter 16 was the beginning of what? The second missionary journey begins, and now we are finally in Acts chapter 17, and we're going to start, it's still part of the second missionary journey, but we're going to start breaking this down into cities, so that way we can memorize Paul's journeys, especially the second one. So it's going to be Thessalonica, Berea, Athens. I know it's three words, but we can do that. Acts chapter 17 is about Thessalonica, Berea, and Athens. We are only going to talk about the first two today. So let's jump right into it. Now, this is really interesting. We're going to see, first of all, a language change. Now, pick up on what you see that's different here. They flee Philippi, and it says, now when they had passed through Amphipolis and Apollonia, they came to Thessalonica, where there was a synagogue of the Jews. Now, I say there's a language change here. What sticks out to you that's different from what we were reading in Acts chapter 16? Go ahead.
The name went. Luke stayed in Philippi.
Okay. Luke, until this point, we had we this and we that and we this because it implied Luke, as the writer, was with them. He had joined up with them and was with them in Philippi. But it appears that Luke stays behind in the city of Philippi as Paul and Silas go on. Why would Luke stay behind in Philippi? Okay, we're going to see in Philippians chapter 1, not long after Paul has visited this congregation, that he writes his epistle back to them, that he's going to write it to the church and the overseers and the deacons there. Someone needed to stay to ensure that teaching continued to happen and that the structure of the church was built up. And we're also going to see something else. We're not going to see Timothy mentioned anywhere in this section until we get to Berea. And so I'm going to argue that it's likely that Timothy also stayed behind in Philippi. And also for this reason, because remember, they're going to leave Philippi and they're going to go to Thessalonica. You're going to start to see Paul's epistles explain what we're reading in the book of Acts. So check this out. When you look at the next section, I didn't put the right transitions on here, I apologize. Paul writes about to the Thessalonians what had happened to him at Philippi, which is interesting. But in Philippians chapter 4, look at this. You Philippians yourselves know that in the beginning of the gospel, when I left Macedonia, no church entered into partnership with me in giving and receiving except you only. What is Paul talking about there when he says entered into partnership with me? Yeah, he's talking about financial support from a church. And he had gone through, and remember, he revisited, and he was at Lystra, and he was in all these Galatian churches, and no one had entered into partnership with him. But when they got to Macedonia, at Philippi, they were willing to support Paul. But look at, this is interesting. He says, even in Thessalonica, that's where we're going to be today, you sent me help for my needs once again. Now, here's how we understand the timeline of Acts. Timothy apparently stays behind in Philippi. He's not in Thessalonica. Hey, Glenn's here. Hi, Glenn.
Hey.
You keep going. But Timothy is in Philippi. We don't know where he is. We just know at some point he links up with Paul and Silas in Berea. Who would be the most likely candidate to go from Philippi to link up with Paul and the rest of them in Thessalonica to bring a gift to Paul? It's going to be Timothy. That's the best answer we have. Paul doesn't state it here, but how we're going to understand this timeline is Paul and Silas are going to leave to go to Thessalonica. And Timothy is going to stay behind in Philippi and later joins up with them so that way he can bring them financial support. And there's going to be more evidence of that in just a moment. But let's go ahead and get into the text. Thessalonica is about 100 miles, by the way, away from Philippi. So about 100 miles that distance these two churches. And so beginning in verse 2, Paul went in, and as was his custom on the three Sabbath days, he reasoned with them from the Scriptures, explaining and proving that it was necessary for the Christ to suffer and rise from the dead, and saying, "This Jesus whom I proclaim to you is the Christ." And some of them were persuaded and joined Paul and Silas, as did many of the devout Greeks, and not a few of the leading women. This is the first time that we see this phrase that Paul reasoned with them from the Scriptures. And what that word literally means is an argument or a debate. And so what would happen is Paul would go into the synagogue, and remember, they would read each Sabbath day, really each day, a portion of the law and the prophets. And from there, Paul would get up and start to reason with them from what was read and citing other scriptures, that the scriptures were all pointing to the fact that Jesus was the Christ. Now, sometimes Paul would be received, but most of the time with the Jews, what would be the response to Paul doing this type of a thing? Yeah. they're gonna send him away, right? And so here, Paul, you can just picture him, though. Maybe he's reading out of Psalm 16, or maybe he's explaining Jonah and how Jonah is a type of Christ, and how just as Jonah was in the belly of the whale 3 days and then was spat up, so the Son of Man would be in the ground 3 days and then rise to by the risen power of the Lord to walk again. And so you can see Paul reasoning with them and explaining to them what has happened, and this was his custom. We know this by Romans 1:16, for the gospel is the power of God to salvation to all who believe, first to the Jew and then also to the Greek. And so Paul would always go to the Jew first. But here's what's interesting. He goes to the synagogue, he starts to reason with them, and 1 Thessalonians chapter 1, verse 5 shows us he also used miraculous signs to confirm his message amongst the Thessalonians. But look at who believes. It says, some of them were persuaded and joined Paul and Silas, and that would be the Jews. There were some of them. But the majority that believed Paul and Silas were who? They were Greek. Now, here when it says devout Greek and leading women, this would have been talking about Greeks in this area that had already become proselytes at the gate. They were pseudo-Jews, so to speak. They didn't have the circumcision. They didn't go through circumcision. But they came to the synagogues and they learned from the law and they tried to obey the law. And so here Paul preaches and reasons with them from the scriptures. And the majority of those who believed were not the Jews, but it was the Greeks again. And that's also evidence in 1 Thessalonians chapter 1, verse 9, where Paul says that you turned away from false idols to serve the true and the living God, which is reminiscent of exactly what Paul is going to say to the Athenians when we get there next week. Yeah.
The Jews rejected, and they can't use the excuse that Paul didn't know what he was talking about. Paul was probably one of the most educated Jews there was. He was trained at Gamaliel's feet. He was a Pharisee of Pharisees. He knew the law inside and out. They really had no excuse. They just didn't want to hear it, is really what it comes down to.
And when we look at Berea in about 15 minutes here, they're going to be a case in point of demonstrating what the other Jews had lacked in other synagogues. The attitude with which they came to the scriptures was different and allowed them to be receptive to the gospel. But when you have an attitude of that, I've already got everything figured out, have you ever tried to tell somebody something when they've already got it all figured out? This is a true story. I couldn't believe it. My brother-in-law was teaching somewhere, and they were teaching about growing in the grace and the knowledge of our Lord Jesus Christ from Peter. And someone legitimately raised his hand and said, well, what if you've already come to an understanding of everything you need to know? And he was serious. And I don't know how he answered that one, but he told me the story. It's amazing, though, because if someone has that kind of an attitude, are you going to be able to teach them anything, regardless of what you show to them or do in front of them? Because that was the Pharisees in Jerusalem, wasn't it? They saw the signs, they saw the miracles. Was it about a lack of evidence or a lack of an understanding of what was right and wrong? It had nothing to do with that. It had everything to do with the fact that they just did not want to accept it. They did not want to change because of the implications that came with it, and so they weren't going to. And in our life, you're going to run into two types of Christians within your own self that you have to battle and master in our spiritual walk. There's going to be the side of us that is receptive to discipline and instruction and understands that I need to grow, and even in things I think I have a solid understanding of, I need to be willing to hear and grow in those things. And then the other side of us is going to be the prideful side. There you go. God opposes the proud, but gives grace to the humble. But the only way to receive the implanted word, James says, is not with pride, but through humility. We're going to have to fight that side. That was what was happening here. Now, just a side point, showing again how the epistles help to explain things that were taking place here. It says, and you guys can probably recognize this, when they went to Berea, it says that they examined the scriptures how often?
Daily.
Here, when were they willing to discuss this with Paul?
On the Sabbath.
So once a week. So Paul meets with them three times, and that could be for a couple reasons. They could have been meeting those other times, and Paul couldn't have met with them. Now, why would that be the case? Why would Paul only be able to meet with them on the Sabbath, but couldn't meet with them any other day? Let's think about that for a moment. That's going to be it. Look at what Paul says to the Thessalonians in both epistles. Chapter 2, verse 9, he says, "For you remember, brothers, our labor and toil, And we worked night and day that we might not be a burden to any of you while we proclaimed to you the gospel of God. And then you look in chapter 3 of the second epistle. For you yourselves know how you ought to imitate us, because we were not idle when we were with you. Nor did we eat anyone's bread without paying for it, but with toil and labor we worked night and day that we might not be a burden to any of you. It was not because we did not have the right, but to give you in ourselves an example to imitate. And he goes on to say that principle, if no one is willing to work, neither let him eat. Now, here we have a predicament that we need to understand. Paul is having to work. Now, I say that with some asterisks next to it. It could be that Paul had to work because they just ran out of money. That's generally what happens with Paul. They think they're going to go here, and they have a plan of where they're going to go, but the Spirit sends them further, and so they keep going further on these journeys. And so it could be that Paul does not have any support that he needs, and so he's having to resort to working with his hands. The other part of it is going to be that he's trying to serve as an example to the Thessalonians, because for whatever reason, Paul thought it beneficial for them to not take their money, to not take their support. Now, that's not the case with every church, because while Paul is in Thessalonica, what does he get from Timothy? Remember? Philippi sends him support. So it could be that Paul was waiting on this support, we don't know, and he didn't want to burden them because he just wanted to bring them the gospel and didn't want them to think that this was some kind of a money ploy or anything, but Paul isn't willing to take their money. He works with his hands during the day, and then on the weekends he's reasoning with them from the scriptures in the synagogue. Just really interesting when you consider what he says in the epistles and the attitude that he brought to them. Because Paul says this, did Paul and Silas have a right to ask them to support them for what they were doing? I mean, they were away from home, they're traveling, they had every single right to ask them for help and support. But that just goes to show you how important the gospel was to Paul. He did not want to put any barrier in the way of having them believe. And if it meant he had to work with his own hands and do double time, he had the ability to do that, and he was going to do that for them in this case. Now, with a church that's already been established, that knows the gospel, we're going to see Paul is willing to enter into partnership with groups like that. But with brand new churches, you don't see Paul doing this, and that's really interesting. So that being said, Paul is reasoning with them. A great number of the Gentiles believe, the Greeks. And so this is going to be the response. It says, but the Jews were jealous. Who's surprised from what we've read in Acts so far? And taking some wicked men of the rabble, they formed a mob and set the city in an uproar and attacked the house of Jason, seeking to bring them out to the crowd. And when they could not find them, they dragged Jason and some of the brothers before the city authorities, shouting, these men have turned the world upside down, have come here also. And Jason has received them, and they are all acting against the decrees of Caesar, saying that there is another King Jesus. And the people of the city authorities were disturbed when they heard these things. And when they had taken money as security from Jason and the rest, they let them go. All right, so let's start here. Why did the Jews act in this kind of way? What does it mean they were jealous? What would they have been jealous of? Paul's not taking money from this group. He goes and he's reasoning from the scriptures with them. Why have they all of a sudden become jealous of Paul and Silas in that group? Yeah, Ryan. Okay, that's going to be it. I want you guys to think about, remember what Paul writes in Romans chapter 2, and he's talking to Jews in this context, and perhaps Jewish Christians, and he says, if you believe you are a guide to the blind and a light to those who are in darkness and an instructor to the foolish, a teacher of children, having in the law the embodiment of the knowledge and truth. The Jews prided themselves in being a light to the heathens and a light to the Gentiles in this dark world. And it sounds like they had quite a gathering of Greeks that had become proselytes that they were teaching and instructing from the law. Now, was there anything wrong with that? Were they doing the right thing before Paul shows up on the scene? Everyone say yes.
Yes.
All right, good. Thanks, David. They're doing the right thing. And yet, when Paul comes, though, he starts to show them that from the law that they are trying to instruct others with, it instructs them to obey the Messiah, Jesus Christ. They had missed him in the law this whole time. And so as Paul goes on to write in Romans chapter 2, they who taught others were not willing to teach themselves. They were not willing to learn from the law themselves. But this group becomes jealous because all of a sudden all these Greeks that they had been teaching have now become Christians and are following Paul and Silas. Yeah, Donna.
Well, they probably got payment from these Greeks also.
It's a possibility. I don't believe so in this context from what Paul writes in the epistles. He didn't take their support by any means.
Not Paul,
the Jews. I hadn't thought about that.
The Jews were probably getting financial support from the Greeks.
I hadn't thought about that. That's a big possibility. And how often is money going to be a root of all kinds of, well, the love of money, a root of all sorts of evil in the book of Acts? We saw it in chapter 16. We're going to see it later on in Ephesus. So that's a big possibility. Dave, you had your hand up.
Well, with that, it talks here they were envious, some of the Jews that were persuaded. And again, when the Jew sits in anger, soon to follow is malice and intent to cause harm. And so what do? They go to evil men, it says, in the marketplace.
That's right.
So here's the Jews who are supposed to be leading. Paul is not working with his hands, and he's giving them the gospel and the gospel of Jesus Christ, and he's doing this with a good attitude and proper disposition. But they grab evil men from the marketplace and insinuate a mob.
That's right.
So what kind of leadership is that?
Yeah. No, that's going to be the common practice of the Jews in each city because they do not want to receive the gospel. And so they do as what happened in Antioch of Pisidia and in Iconium and in Lystra. They stir up the heathens and stir up a mob, and they go to find Paul and Silas. They were staying in the house of who Paul in Romans 16, I believe verse 21, calls his kinsman Jason, which implies that he was likely a Jew. It doesn't mean blood with Paul. It just means he was probably a Jew. We don't know anything else about him other than that likely the church met in his home because it says that they couldn't find Paul and Silas, but they grabbed some of the other brothers. So a lot of Christians are in Jason's home here. And they grab Jason, they pull him in front of the city authorities. Now, this is just a side note. Before we get into the rest of this, this word, city authorities, whenever you see a word that's only used one time and is never used anywhere else, usually it's a red flag. This is a word you don't see anywhere else in the New Testament, and you don't see anywhere else for a long period of time in any classical Greek writing. And so a lot of scholars thought Luke got this wrong, because we don't read about this type of government anywhere else. And the word there is actually politarchs. Now, what's interesting, though, is for a long time, scholars debated and argued Luke was wrong, Luke didn't get his information right. But then, as our friend Luke Chandler presented to us, how often does archaeology all of a sudden reveal things about the scriptures that confirm what the scriptures have always said? And as they started to dig, they found seven different inscriptions of names beneath the city that were all politarchs of this city. And as they started to do more, they found other inscriptions in Macedonia, five of which were all in Thessalonica that said politarchs was the regular title for political leaders in that city. So again, Luke was correct. All of the scholars that said Luke was wrong were incorrect. Yet again, archaeology confirms what the scriptures say about when things happened and who was in charge. So that aside, they drag them in front of these politarchs, And here's their accusations they're going to bring. Now, do they have anything on Jason and these brethren? No, they are only guilty of associating with these men. We're going to see that that's going to be the reason that they have such a peaceful letting go process, or a peaceful release. That's a better way to say that. Here's their claims, though. These men who have turned the world upside down. I love that. Isn't that what Jesus did? Jesus took everything that people thought they knew and flipped it on its head. You have heard it said, love your neighbor and hate your enemy, but I say to you, love your enemy, and you guys finish it. Pray for those who persecute you. How often did Jesus take everything that people thought they knew about what was right and about God and about morality and just turned it upside down? And that's what these men had done to the Roman system, among the Greeks, amongst the Jews. They had turned the world upright. And they say, and Jason has received them. That would be Paul and Silas. And they are acting against the decrees of Caesar, saying there is another king, Jesus. Now, let's try to bring our memories back to last week. There were laws amongst the Romans that said if you were practicing a particular religion, when Rome took over whatever city you were from, you were free to continue to observe and practice that religion. But what was one of the requirements from Rome regarding religion and religious practices? There couldn't be anything new. And you could not introduce a new teaching. And also one of the decrees of Caesar was that there was no other king besides Caesar. And to follow or claim another king is treason, and it would cost you your life. Remember, that's what Pilate asked Jesus. He said, are you a king? And that was one of the things that they tried to stir up Pilate towards, and the mob cried out, we have no king but Caesar. Now, is this true that they were preaching about another king? Technically, yes. But have they twisted the words of Paul and Silas to conveniently bring them a death sentence? That's what they've done here. What's interesting, we won't take the time to read it all, but if you look through the first and second epistle of Thessalonians, in chapter 1 Thessalonians chapter 4, verse 14, in chapter 5, verse 2 and 23, in 2 Thessalonians chapter 1, verses 7 through 8, and in chapter 2, verses 1 through 12, you're going to see this theme of Christ's kingship and his kingdom throughout both of those epistles. They were obviously teaching about Christ being the king and his kingdom when they were in Thessalonica. That was heavy in Paul's teaching. And so they took that and they ran with it to try to twist the words to bring about a death sentence upon Paul and Silas. Now, when the Plutarchs heard this, the magistrates here of this city, are they going to be disturbed by this? You know, but the problem is, they're saying these men are doing this, but where are the men? They don't know where they are. So, are you going to execute this innocent man that had them in his home? Well, for all they know, they don't know how much of a dealing he has with them. Roman law would say you can't. And so at this point, they just say, all right, we're going to take some money from you, and we're going to let you go. So they let Jason and the brothers go, and this would have been an unfair amount of money. Remember when John the Baptist was talking to the Roman soldiers, and he said, be content with your wages? The reason for that is a lot of times, Romans would manipulate citizens and Jews, and they would extract money from them that they didn't possess and that shouldn't have been theirs. Probably not right what took place here, but they take this bribe, so to speak, and they say, okay, we're going to let you go. But that wouldn't have been the case if they actually would have had Paul and Silas there, and that's going to be evidenced by what they do immediately. The brothers immediately sent Paul and Silas away by night to Berea. Why by night and why immediately?
So they wouldn't get caught.
That's it. their life is in danger, and they're probably looking for them, and we're going to know that they're looking for them, because when they find out they're in Berea, guess what the Jews do? They come from Thessalonica down to Berea to cause more trouble for Paul. They figure out he's escaped, and they follow him all the way down. But Paul gets to Berea, which is about a 50-mile journey. They would have had to travel all through the night and all through the day. And it says, and when they arrived, they went into the Jewish synagogue. Again, Paul's custom. There's a synagogue there. The first place he's going to go is into the synagogue. And if you were Paul, I mean, at this point, I would be thinking, here we go again. Same process. We're going to preach. Some Gentiles are going to believe. The Jews are going to chase us out. And then we're going to have to go to the next city and risk our lives. Because that's been the theme. At Antioch and Pisidia, the first journey, at Iconium and at Lystra. And here we have it at Thessalonica. Paul's having to flee for his life. But that is not going to be how Paul is received, which is amazing. Verse 11. Now these Jews were more noble than those in Thessalonica. Now that word noble literally translates of high birth or high standing. You know where the term noblemen, you know, that would be what this is referring to. Now here's the question, does Luke mean in writing this that those that were in Berea were a higher class of people socially than those in Thessalonica? That's a possibility. But when you look at the context, what Luke appears to be saying is that their way of thinking or that their attitude was that which was higher or more noble than that of the Jews that were in Thessalonica. Does that make sense? And here's going to be the evidence of that. It says, they received the word with all eagerness, examining the scriptures daily to see if these things are so. And many of them believed, therefore, and not a few Greek women of high standing as well as men. Let's break this down when we talk about the Bereans. The first thing we need to recognize is it says that they received the word with all eagerness. Every other place you look, whenever the gospel came to a synagogue, what was the attitude that most Jews greeted Paul and Silas or Barnabas with when they presented the gospel? You know, it was not eagerness. They did not want the word. They didn't want to have anything to do with the word. In fact, they would make sure that Paul would no longer preach the word in their city, and they made sure of it. Here's what's so different about this group of Jews is they are eager to receive instruction from the word. Now, had they studied the word their entire life, these Jews, they knew the word. They knew the law. They knew the prophets. But they were still willing to receive instruction from them and humble themselves to admit that maybe they had never seen these things the way that they should. So the first thing we need to learn from the Bereans is, do we receive the word with all eagerness? Now, a lot of times we are eager to hear what we already know is right. You know, we have itching ears to hear what we have already come to the conclusion of. The expression, birds of a feather flock together. So I try to find people that agree with what I've already, you know, come to a conclusion of, and that's who I'm going to listen to. But do I challenge myself, though? Do I listen to someone who is from the Scriptures, discerning and bringing the Word, and reasoning from the Scriptures, and maybe at first I've never seen it that way? Am I willing to humble myself to look at the Scriptures to actually see if these things are so? Am I eager for that? So that's the first thing. The second thing you see about it is this receiving was daily. Now, we don't know for certain, but all we know that was recorded for us is at Thessalonica, how often were they reasoning from the Scriptures? Weekly. It wasn't daily, as far as we know. Now, that might not be the case. It might just be that Paul was working, and so the only time he had was on the Sabbath. Let's just give that credit. But let's just think about ourselves. If the only time we pick up our Bible and open this up to receive God's instruction in our life is on Sunday when we come here, then we've got a serious spiritual problem that we're facing. Because this implies that they had urgency to understand what God's will was for them. It was not enough for them to wait to the next week to hear Paul speak more. It was not enough for them to kind of think about these things and go, oh, that's a very different teaching than I've ever heard. I'll put it in the back of my mind and come back to it at some point. When they heard this, they were not going to stop getting into the Word until they came to the right conclusion, until they came to the right answer. They had urgency, and so daily they were in the Scriptures to see if these things were so. And so just think about our lives. How do we approach understanding God's will in our life? Is it a daily thing that I get into the Word? Or is it enough for me to just be, quote, spiritually medicated on Sunday and then leave the rest to go throughout the week? Yeah, Dad.
Well, the example I've always liked to use, BJ, is that you look at your spiritual body. It needs to be fed, too. And if you take the physical body, if you go 7 days without eating, you're going to be very, very weak. And make the application. You go several days without nourishing yourself spiritually, you're going to be very weak as a Christian.
That's right. That's right.
So be strong and nourish yourselves daily.
Yeah. 7 days without reading makes one week. W-E-A-K. Ha, there you go. There's your pun for the day. All right. The third thing they were doing, and we've already talked about this some, is they were examining the Scriptures daily to see if these things were so. They did not simply take Paul's word for it, but they went back to the Scriptures to see if these things were so. That tells us something about their attitude regarding the Word of God. They had an absolute respect for the authority of God's Word. They knew that the Messiah was coming. They knew that the Christ was coming. And if Jesus really was this Christ, they knew that the law and the prophets were going to confirm that that was so. And so it wasn't about just hearing this teaching and believing anything that someone brought to them, as we're going to see was the case with most everyone in Athens, but they had an absolute respect for the authority of God's Word. And because of this, that is what was going to allow them to believe and lead them to salvation. Remember what Paul writes to the Galatians, that the law was a tutor to lead them to Christ. Jack has taught about this before. That word tutor, the equivalent would be like a school bus, is the word that's used there. It was the schoolmaster that brought them from one place to another. And here, because of their respect for the Word, when they examined the Scriptures, it brought them right to where they needed to be. It brought them to Christ. In the case of the other Jews, they saw it in front of their eyes. They saw the reasoning from the Scriptures. They saw the miracles that confirmed what Paul was saying, but they didn't have a respect for what God had said to them because it clashed with what they wanted, and so they rejected it. Here we see someone who is willing to receive instruction because of their respect for the authority of God's Word, and because of it, a great number of them believed. And a great number of them weren't just the Jews, but it was also going to be the Greeks. But here's what's interesting about this is, I just want to make this point. You can do all three of these things honestly without ever really making the jump to do number four. And here's what I mean by that. When you consider all the other Jews, they were without excuse. They heard what Paul said. They saw the Scriptures. They saw the signs. Was there any doubt in their mind that what Paul was saying was true? There shouldn't have been. It was all right in front of them. But why wouldn't you want to make the change? Why wouldn't you want to make that jump? You see what the Scriptures are saying. You see that Jesus is the Christ. The natural inclination by seeing the signs and being the Scriptures is that if I love God and trust God, I need to obey what the Word is pointing me to and obey Christ. But you see a principle here. Change is hard. Change is difficult. And every time when I look in the Word, how many times do I recognize that this is right and it's telling me something, but I still don't do it because of what it means for me in my life? Because of the change that it's going to bring about in my life, and I'm not willing to go through that change. And so I just stay comfortable knowing that I'm wrong, but I don't want to go through that change. Yeah, Brandon. Okay.
It's easier for someone to die than to deal with the fact that someone can say something harsh or can say, okay, you know, I separated from you because for whatever reason. Mm-hmm.
And that would have been very well a likely thing that's taking place here, because did they know how the other Jews in other areas responded to this gospel? You know, they're going to pretty soon when they come down from Thessalonica to Berea, but they're going to be under fire from the Jews, and we read that in Paul's epistles to the Thessalonians. We are out of time. I just want to read this, and then next week we're going to get to a couple of different things, and then we'll get into Athens. But McGarvey has this to say. He says, "There is scarcely a greater sin than to stop our ears when God speaks, or to close our eyes to the truth which he brings before us. All who profess to be disciples of Christ should search the Scriptures upon the presentation of everything offering a decent claim to be God's truth, and see whether these things are so. To follow implicitly wherever the Word of God leads can never be unacceptable to its author." And I just thought that was such a great summary of one of these great lessons that we can still learn from this first century church. All right, we are out of time. We're going to get into all this next week. Thank you so much.